Welcome to the Currency.News podcast. It pays to be curious.
It was backed by a number of billionaires, one of whom was Rupert Murdoch. And it was set up in Ireland. InTrade was the Dublin-based company that can legitimately claim to be the world's first prediction market. The trouble was, it was 25 years, a quarter of a century, before its time. And over the next couple of days, our associate editor, Alan English, is going to be revealing how it came to be operating in Ireland, what went wrong, and the personalities behind it. Alan, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Ian.
We'll talk about the personalities and some. It literally reads like a Netflix drama. But I want to start off, because the last time we did a podcast promoting one of your pieces, it was about John Moran and the Limerick mayoral issues. And you were very personal in that, in the sense of you're from Limerick and you had covered all of those personalities. I think you're even more personally invested for a period in what went on in InTrade.
Yeah, that's right, Ian. Kind of very much out of the blue, I got a phone call from the two main founders, John McNamara and Ron Bernstein. I had a brief foray into online journalism with Independent News and Media via a company they had acquired called Internet Ireland. But that went south very, very fast. So we're talking the summer of 2000, so 26 years ago now almost. So I sort of moved back to London after only 6 weeks, and there's a story within that as well, which I sort of tell briefly in the piece. And then out of the blue, I get a phone call to go and meet these two Americans at a hotel just off Sloane Square in Chelsea. And they were the founders of what became known as InTrade. At the time, it was being called Global Sports Exchange. And it sounded kind of like a revolutionary concept. So the idea was that basically you would take bookmakers out of the equation. You would use the power of the internet to bring buyers and sellers together in an online marketplace. And these guys had come from a trading background. They were the sort of traditional Wall Street traders in the open outcry pits. You know, the guys you'll see in the movies with their in the colored jackets, shouting the numbers. They were those type of guys.
But this idea, let's just, again, I do want to come to the personalities and in a moment, but just so people can understand it, there's a fever out there around the dot-com, the internet, the future, all of that sort of stuff. You're a journalist, you get a call, you go to work with these guys. If you were having a dinner party with your wife, how would you explain to them what the business was? What was the pitch?
Yeah, the pitch was basically you're using the power of the internet. So these guys thought they traded anything, like they traded cotton, grain, and they never even so much as saw any of the commodities that they were trading. For them, it was just a commodity to be traded and in and out, and to use their sort of skills in determining when to buy and when to sell. And, you know, what were the arbitrage
opportunities? What was the attraction for you, Alan, as a journalist to go into this? And obviously you had been pushing, and it comes out in the piece, you had been pushing Independent News and Media to move towards a more digital operation. But for you to leave journalism to go into this, what was the, you know, when you're looking at
well,
that
interest? Well, I was probably swept up in that whole dot-com fever. Around that time, and it was an amazing time, really, and it was sort of fortunes being made. So it was in around the time when things were starting to unravel that I came on board, firstly with INM and then with InTrade. I think it was just the excitement of the future. You know, I could see the world beyond printed newspapers. So that was for the first job. And then the second job, I thought, well, God, you know, I barely got a little glimpse of working in the online world when I left it. And now I was being offered another opportunity to have a crack at it.
Yeah.
And not only that, I was being told by these guys that this was going to be the next eBay. And I was being offered options.
And it could have been, Alan, this is the point. And I suppose this is why we're writing about it now, that Polymarket and Kaltchai, these companies have phenomenal valuations, but InTrade was ahead of its time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, and the reason we're writing about it now is because, as you said, Kalshi, which is has largely got an American customer base, has a valuation, current valuation of $22 billion. And Polymarket, which has got a more of a worldwide sort of customer base, is currently seeking funding at a $15 billion valuation. So, what they are doing is exactly, and I mean exactly, what Intrade was doing more than 20 years ago, Ian. So it was a brilliant idea. It was clear it was a brilliant idea. But the problem was it was ahead of its time in the sense that the regulatory situation in America back then was very different. And it took more than two decades to sort of clear up and allow these new operators, Kalshi, Polymarket, to, I guess, realize the potential that was there all along for Intrade. Okay. I mean, there was one of the you've mentioned Rupert Murdoch as one of the billionaire investors. Another billionaire investor who's currently worth, I think, $8.1 billion today was Paul Tudor Jones, an absolute legend of Wall Street, hedge fund manager. And he described Intrade as a 200 bagger, basically meaning that he thought it could realize 200 times his investment. So there was huge excitement about it. It was a great idea. The technology was absolutely first class. We had a brilliant tech team. They were building this platform. It was a complicated thing to
pull off. What were you doing for them, Alan? What were you doing?
What I was doing, my job was director of content, Ian. So Ron Bernstein, you know, he loved his business jargon, and he would be saying, you know, at that time the buzzword was, you know, content is king, and we need great content. So, and the content I was kind of charged with providing was giving people information that would allow them to assess their trading, you know, whether it was around a sporting fixture, give them sort of informed analysis of what was about to unfold. You know, so it was basically sort of giving them the kind of reading that would inform their thoughts on how to trade and basically get them invested in the trading
platform. Yeah, no, it's a riveting read. I've read it. It's going out over the next couple of days on the site. It'd be impossible, Alan, to talk about this story without mentioning one name, John Delaney. Not from the FAI. Not the FAI, John Delaney, we'll be clear on this, but a man who grew up in a house alongside a family pub in County Laois. And in terms of the rise and fall of Intrade, this man's story is spectacular.
Yeah. So John Delaney, I was there a couple of months when the money, there was initially, they had raised a relatively modest amount of money in the Series A, fundraising, and then we were all sort of waiting for the big money to come through from Murdoch and Tudor Jones, and it did come through. So they raised about $13.5 million, which back then was a lot of money, and it gave us a lot of purchasing power to get the idea to launch. So one of the first hires after that money came through was John Delaney, who was brought in as kind of like finance officer. And, you know, he kind of struck me immediately as he was 31 years old. As you say, he'd come from Ballinakil, County Laois. Struck me as a guy who felt he had something to prove. But I didn't, not in a million years, did I think that within 2 years, John Delaney would become the CEO of Intrade. And as you say, his story is what kind of gives it that kind of Netflix quality. Quite remarkable, really. A very, very unusual character. And it's a long story, and it unfolds over, I think, 12,000 words. But to sort of give people describe it in a nutshell, the founders, the American founders who'd come to Dublin, Ron and John, and there were one or two others, were starting to feel nervous about the regulatory situation. It was a different climate back then, and they were starting to worry about being Americans associated with this when the law was starting to look like this could be an illegal business in the United States. they had had some expert legal advice that were suggesting that they weren't betting, that they were sort of facilitating trades between buyers and sellers. But the whole thing was quite unclear. So they moseyed back to America and kind of went, went below the radar. And John Delaney then emerged as the CEO. And then within quite a short space of time, John Delaney became extremely well known in the U.S. business world. He appeared regularly on CNBC Business Channel, and he was on Fox Business, and started appearing in places like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal. And the whole idea of a prediction market, which is what Intrade became after a very short time, started taking off. And there was huge interest in it. So John Delaney was a very articulate advocate for the company. And he would go on, and they were offering kind of unusual markets that were capturing the public imagination, like, would Saddam Hussein be captured and killed? A yes or no proposition. And you could trade on that. So, and basically what Kalshi and Polymarket do is offer a range of possibility between 0 and 100 on whether something will happen. So, for example, Polymarket are currently offering a market on the Dublin Central by-election. And Jerry, the Hutch Monk, there's been over $1 million traded on that market. Half of it
probably
has
by
been
himself.
Traded on. Yeah, well, we don't know about that now, but I mean, you would suspect that he or his associates have been having a dip at this. So over half of it is almost half of it has been traded on the Monk, and he's got a 15%. The market says he's got a 15% chance. And the reason the academics in America were getting really excited was it was because it was proven that Intrade's markets were more accurate than even the most prestigious polling companies in terms of determining the outcomes of presidential elections, wow. Senate elections. The power of money was seen as a predictive power.
There was probably an organic sense to it as well, that people are going in and they're betting, and you can get that sense. And I suppose that's what the likes of Polymarket have done. I don't want to give too much away, and like I say, Alan, but I think we need to talk about John Delaney and how he died, because, like I say, you can Google his name and it'll come up, because, like I said at the start, and when we talked about this over the last couple of weeks, it is a Netflix drama, and his death and what happened after his death, I think, is kind of the climax of that drama.
Yeah. So I went to Ballinakil, his home village, and spoke to a lot of people who would have known him as a child and as a younger man. A fascinating story, really. You know, he was a very unusual character. I mean, he ran a marathon, for example, on the morning of his wedding. He went up and down Carrantool in Ireland. Five times within the space of 24 hours. He's just sort of driven to these sort of extreme adventure challenges. And one of the ones that particularly piqued his interest was the idea of climbing Mount Everest. So he had one crack at it in 2006, and it's described in the piece that he didn't get to the top for reasons that the piece gets into. And then he decided to have another go in 2011, you know, so he's still CEO of Intrade. Intrade is still getting a lot of, it's being pursued by the CFTC in America for being an illegal operation. It's constantly sort of on the back foot legally, but it has a big customer base and has getting great publicity still. So anyway, in the midst of all this, he decides he's going to climb Mount Everest
a second time,
yeah. He gets to within 50 meters of the summit and collapses and dies, and sadly, what he didn't know was that 2 days before he died, he had become a father for the third time. A baby girl who was called who was called Hope, had just been born. He didn't know about that. And unfortunately, he died in so far up the mountain that they couldn't recover his body, and his corpse is still on Everest. So there was a memorial service 6 days later in Ballinakil, and there was rumours sweeping the village that John Delaney wasn't dead at all, and that he was such an unusual guy that they were half expecting. Some people were genuinely told me that they were expecting him to turn up to his own memorial service. It's kind of extraordinary, really. But then intrigue carries on. Ron Bernstein, who had left because he felt the regulatory climate was too hot for him, he had left way back in 2002, 2003. He returns as CEO. Things are up in a bit of a heap because Delaney has, they didn't even know that he was going to climb Everest. And then 2 years after his death, Intrade overnight freezes customer accounts and puts out a statement saying that there may be irregular activity, and that there was no explanation for almost $3 million in payments made before John Delaney's death and the year before his death to bank accounts that he controlled. So that basically was the end of Intrade. There's more to the story than that, which can people read. But
yeah, had you left by that point, Alan?
I had left by then. Yeah, I didn't stick around that long. I left before the launch. The launch was a huge high profile launch in London on the 2nd of August 2001. I was at the launch because I was still on very good terms with the founders and with the staff, and I was back in London at that stage, so I went along to the launch. It was an extraordinary affair, really. Nearly every taxi in London was bedecked in the Intrade livery. The Evening Standard was completely dominated. The business section, you couldn't move for ads for Intrade. You went down to the tube stations, and the platforms in around the square mile had massive Intrade posters all over them. Massive amount of money spent on the launch. But ultimately, it was also competing at the same time. Betfair came out, and that was also a business proposition that sort of eliminated the bookmaker and brought buyers and sellers together in an online marketplace. And it was a simpler thing to understand, which was one of the reasons why Intrade didn't get traction initially. And one of the reasons why the founders went back to America.
So Alan, we've been chatting, and I don't want to give too much away. I want people to sit down and read the piece over the next 2 days. But it's a fascinating story and a fascinating chapter in your own life. And I suppose you came to it now because exactly what they were doing is exactly what's being so successful at the moment.
Yeah, I know. I genuinely had a conviction that that this was a great idea. I didn't know about the regulatory situation in the United States. All I knew was that there was high quality people involved in this. The CFO, the chief technical officer, a brilliant operator called Nick Berry, who's gone on to a very successful career with Susquehanna. So there was really good people in it. It was a great idea. It had the backing as of three different billionaires. Stanley Druckenmiller was the third one. And at one stage, when I asked one of the first employees, we were sitting in his apartment in Harcourt Green the night before I started, and I said to him, Jack, what if Paul Tudor Jones is right and this is a 200 bagger? What would my stake be worth? You know, because I had share options, and he asked me how many options I had and what the vesting terms were, etc. Then he took out a calculator, started tapping, and then he told me that if Paul Tudor Jones was right, my options were going to be worth $22 million, you know. So that was quite a nice moment for a journalist who, let's face it, we don't tend to get into journalism.
Not for the money.
For the money, Ian.
Tell me about it.
So, but he was, look, It was a fun time. You know, I look back on it fondly. It was probably the one chance I ever had to become rich, and it was in the midst of this dot-com frenzy.
This gold rush, finally, Alan. And like I say, it's a great story, but what can people expect over the next 2 days from this piece? And like I say, it's well worth a read.
Yeah, well, they can expect really the story, the founder's story. I mean, I've got in touch with, I mean, I've spoken to people who I hadn't been in touch with for 25 years, really, Ian, and it was great to catch up with them again. We all kind of shared something. We all thought we were on board something that could lead somewhere big. You know, they've gone off in different directions. John McNamara, who was the guy who came up with the idea in the first place, I spoke to him, and he's now, well, I won't spoil it for people, but let's just say he isn't where he thought he might be 25 years ago. And then there's the whole John Delaney story. I mean, it's fascinating going to Ballinakil, County Laois, and to get a sort of a deeper sense of what sort of a guy he was. And then there's the parallel story of Kalshi and Polymarket, which was basically proof that this was a great idea in the first place. And it's kind of a story really that hasn't been told from an insider perspective. I felt all along that there was a great story there, and I guess it just needed the emergence of Kalshi and Polymarket to make it relevant and to make it timely.
Well, Alan, we won't give too much more away, but the full story, should I say, of InTrade's rise and fall is told by you. You're part of the senior management team when John Delaney was first appointed. You left the Sunday Times, and now 25, 26 years later, you're telling the inside story of what occurred in what could have been a $22 million payout for you.
Billion, Ian.
A billion, yeah, there you go.
Well, $22 million for me and $22 billion, that's what Kalshi is worth now, apparently.
There you go. Alan English, Associate Editor with The Currency, thanks for joining me. And like I say, the piece will be going on The Currency over the next 2 days. So thanks, Alan.
Thank you, Ian.
You've been listening to the Currency.news podcast. It pays to be curious.